Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, toy department time, everybody. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. I am not afraid of the broadcaster jinx, Kolsky.
Yeah, you make this clear on a regular basis, and I will just say I don't have the stats in front of me, but I want to say that the broadcaster jinx is undefeated against you.
Look, I will grant you in the history of the show that pretty much every time I've said it, I think of all the times I've said it's going to be a short show, it's been a short show maybe twice. I'm just north of the Washington Generals.
I think you're being very kind to yourself. I think one is the absolute maximum number of wins for you in this. And, you know, but look, tempt fate all you want. You know what I'm saying? It's not, it matters not to me.
Okay.
The funniest part about all of this to me is that every time we have this conversation, the listener already knows the answer to whether or not you've succeeded. So it's your failure in predicting a short show is experienced instantaneously by anyone listening to our podcast.
Or success today.
Right. Sure. Theoretically.
Of course, the irony is the longer we debate this, the further away get from the goal, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so we've got some television to cover today. I think it's all television, right? Basically, in whatever weird ass forms television takes in the year 2021.
I suppose so. I guess I might call the Tiger Doc more of a 2-part movie, but it's 2 episodes, so I guess it's TV. I don't know. Who cares?
Yeah. Well, you watched it on TV.
That's I did, but yeah. I watch it like when we rent a movie this week, that's a movie, right?
Even yeah,
if we were watching it on our TV.
But that is a movie that you would have watched in theater if theaters
right.
were currently a
and
thing.
And you're right.
You know what I mean? So that's
I would
a much
not,
easier line.
Yeah, that's not true with the title. Yeah. That's correct. A fine line, folks.
All right. Do you want to start with Tiger then?
Sure. Why not? I already brought it up.
Yeah. So we're here. I was my one disappointment is that the next part of this doesn't air until next Sunday.
Yeah.
I was fully expecting it to watch it last night. And they sort of left us on a cliffhanger, which
yeah,
I think
they
is
did.
An interesting thing for a documentary to do.
That was clearly the intention, and I thought it worked perfectly because I, too, was very annoyed that I could not just stream the next episode. I don't know if that is the goal, I don't know why, but hey, here we are, and man, this dude is one of the most interesting people in the history of the world.
Well, all right, so it's interesting that you say that.
It doesn't mean he's an interesting personality.
Yeah, okay, great. I was going to say, like, I mean, look, I come into this, obviously, my feelings about the game of golf are well documented.
You caught yourself. You almost said sport because you know it's a sport. You have
I
to
do
edit
not.
Yourself because you're well aware that it's a sport, but go on.
I do not. Golf is America's most loathsome enterprise. I think we've also talked somewhat about my feelings about Tiger in that I used to kind of really enjoy Tiger because I felt it was sort of a thumb in the eye to all of that, to golf culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, and you can see this in the documentary, that became less so pretty quickly. You know, golf just kind of sucked him in, and eventually he really just sort of became golf.
Sucking him in, or is that him transcending?
Yeah, it's fine. I was not trying to slight golf. He transcended golf, yeah. He was Michael Jordan of golf, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But through that whole time, like, he was never interesting. He's not an interesting person, which I think is part of the foibles, I think, or what led to, I think, some of his foibles, the fact that he wasn't really sort of, you know, he's basically Todd Marinovich, right? So
in a lot of ways, yes, although obviously far more successful than Todd Marinovich.
Right. Obviously, this guy had an interesting career and a very interesting life. But I don't know that it's necessarily like a giant ball of clay for the filmmakers to just shape into an excellent documentary. And so I say that to say that they did an incredible job, because the part one of this I thought was riveting.
See, but I do think the story is riveting. I mean, I agree with everything you said, except the part where, like, he is not, Tiger does not have a magnetic personality, but it's, I found it fascinating to hear from his high school girlfriend, or you know, high school into college, talking about essentially, like, watching the humanity be sucked out of a child by his parents' relentless desire for him to succeed.
Yeah, like, and what happened to him is interesting. He's not interesting. I guess that's my point.
Sure, but I mean, I think the story, and this is not to slight the filmmakers, who I agree did a phenomenal job, the story surrounding him is fascinating. And his ascendance is fascinating. And, you know, we're about to see some of the fall, and that's fascinating. It's one of the most fascinating and also deeply American stories in our history. It really is.
It is a deeply American story. Sort of, it touches on a lot of different levels of society. It's kind of, it reminds me a little bit of OJ Made in America, right? In that, like, OJ's not necessarily, he's had a lot more personality than Tiger, but he's not necessarily the most interesting, thoughtful guy, right? But his story intersects with all of these things in our society, right? So and I feel like Tiger's story does something similar, and I feel like the filmmakers did a really good job of pointing that out. You know what I mean? Like,
no, I totally agree.
It's so well constructed and well paced, and like, it's just, and they got, you know, obviously they doesn't seem like they really have Tiger.
No,
but
well, and I was thinking about that. If you were making a documentary about Tiger Woods, okay. No, look, obviously you ask for Tiger, you hope to get Tiger, but do you think there's any world in which you can tell the actual story if Tiger is participating?
I think, here's what, to answer that question, I think there is a world, but it's, you'd have to wait for a super specific moment. It's The Last Dance, basically, right? Like, you'd have to sort of sit around and wait until you got Tiger at a moment where he really wanted to do this and was really willing to take you into what was going on in a real way, or at least a close to real way. Because I think that we, you know, Michael Jordan had his own agendas in The Last Dance. But I would say Michael Jordan was willing to be vulnerable, right, in that documentary in a way that he wasn't for almost the entirety of Michael Jordan's public life, right? Like, they found him at the right moment when he was willing to do it.
Yeah.
And I imagine there's a moment for Tiger where that would be true, but almost any time you wanted to make this with his participation, it would be bland, right? So,
yeah. And to your point, he's not an interesting person, really. So hearing from him just doesn't feel that necessary or compelling to me, strangely enough.
It's inessential. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So I just, like, you're probably right, although I will say that Tiger is an even more introverted person, and his sins are worse than Michael Jordan's. So I don't know that time is ever going to happen. Like, I understand the theoretical time that you are thinking of, and it might very well exist someday. But we're nowhere near it, and I'm... If you had asked me whether that would eventually happen with Jordan, I always would have said yes. I'm not so sure
really?
With Tiger. Oh yeah.
Yeah. I would guess.
Like, Michael wanted you to know. You know what I mean? I don't.
Yeah.
No one ever doubted whether Mike wanted everybody to know who the best was.
Right. But I think Tiger will be like that too. And I think there will be some point, I would guess it would be about when he is the age that, say, Jack Nicklaus is now.
Oof.
That he will want to reassert his legacy in some sort of way, and then you might get something like this. That would be my guess. Obviously, I don't know. Who knows the future? But I think then maybe you'd get him.
Maybe.
But regardless, short of, you know, that, and maybe not even really handicapped by that, as you said, like they really did get a lot of people around them.
Yeah.
And most of them are pretty candid. You know what I mean?
I thought the scene with his like dad's golf pro buddy talking about the influences that they probably had on a young Tiger was incredible and a little bit heartbreaking.
Yeah, that was. It's funny that you say that because when as I was thinking of that, that was literally the scene I was thinking about, and you could tell that guy had done some reflection.
Yeah.
On this topic prior to this interview, you know what I mean?
Totally.
So, yeah, it was interesting. And honestly, I wanted to know a little bit more about, you know, what those guys were doing or what was happening with Earl and the Winnebago or whatever. You know what I mean? I understand why they weren't going to get into it. But,
right.
You know, if you're saying that this was the thing that put Tiger down the path that almost nearly undid him. And maybe they'll get, obviously there's, you know, it seems like we're going to get a little more into that in part two. Maybe,
I think
maybe
that's
we'll come back to
precisely
it.
Precisely the content of part two.
Yeah.
I mean, like the teaser at the end, the cliffhanger is, I don't even know how to put this, but like one of Tiger's, you know, women of ill repute sitting down and being like, all right, let's do this.
It's like, what are we? She's like, what are we talking about now?
LOL.
So great. So
LOL.
Great. I'm assuming that was the Perkins waitress, but I'm just assuming.
I don't remember their names. One of them got a little more famous than the others, if I recall correctly. But yeah, I assume that's her too. And look, you know, this. While obviously there are some salacious details here, this documentary has been reasonably classy to this point, so I am interested to see what this next part looks like.
Yeah. You know, there's one specter I felt like part one kind of sidestepped, and I'm assuming because, right, they're working from the Armin Katayan book, like source material. Uh-huh. I'm assuming it wasn't in there and that they don't really have enough to kind of go there, but you know they kind of roll through Tiger's like weightlifting period.
Right, where, oh, I don't think
where
they
he
did.
Gets huge.
I don't
has,
think they did. There's
with,
so
the spectrum
much
steroids
more.
Does not come up though, does it?
Well, I don't know that. I don't think you can do that if you have no proof, and I right. doubt that these filmmakers did like an exhaustive, you know. Like investigation into his potential.
That's what I'm saying. Like I don't know that they had the material to include it, but does it not jump out at you when you're watching the, you know, as you're watching those scenes and he's getting huge and his like biceps are rippling and he's working out all the time?
Let me say a couple of things. First of all, and this is probably the most important thing. Fundamentally, I don't care whether he used, quote, steroids or not. I don't even really believe that, quote, steroids, I'm doing finger quotes right now, are even a thing in the way we conceived them for most of my childhood. Especially not for someone with as much power and money as Tiger. What did he use to get big? I don't know. But when I was a little kid, creatine was totally cool, and now it's banned. So, like, I guarantee he's putting some powders in his body. How do I know if it's the one off the shelf at GNC or a special cocktail brewed up by the expensive doctors he's paying? I don't know. But I don't care. I don't believe he is doing that stuff or allowed to do that stuff any more than anyone else. And the entire tour got strong between the beginning of Tiger's career and now. The whole tour.
After he did. Right? Maybe. You know, that's the other thing. It's like, he's crushing people with these drives, right? And they're acting like, oh, he just wants it more than Phil. And, I mean, I think that's true. I think he did want it more than Phil, but I don't think that's the only thing that's happening there. You know what I mean?
Well, just let me ask you this. What do you think is stopping Phil from getting into the same level of shape as Tiger by using whatever the same basic products are.
Nothing. You know, look, I...
No. Not,
our feelings
hold on,
about
I'm just
steroids
saying,
and sports
no,
are
no,
the same.
Just hang with me here. Is it? Sure. It's not morality, is it?
No.
Okay.
I agree.
In fact, I think if we want to really be serious, it's probably laziness. That's probably the thing. So I'm okay with the guy who's a little lazier not getting in as good. Like, just nothing about it bothers me on any level. But the other part of it is, like, I really do think there's a fine line between illegal performance-enhancing drugs and supplements. And I don't know that I have any faith with how that line is drawn. So I'm just not that concerned about stuff like this.
I agree, too. I'm not saying, like, oh, this is the thing that, like, we should take Tiger down with this. Or, like,
I know you're not.
I think the line is fine. Yeah.
All I'm really saying, though, is, like, what are you going to say about that if you have no evidence and it doesn't matter?
Right. My point is there was a really obvious story sort of lurking right beneath it that kind of really goes unsaid, and it's even like it's not applied, it's just there, you know what I mean?
I guess I just don't think of it as a storyline, I suppose.
I do think I don't know, it's a storyline as much as like the stories about him practicing all the time or you know, not talking to people or whatever. I do think that this doc was also a really kind of interesting time capsule, you know, to like go back to the 90s. Like, I think a lot about like the Koblenation period, you know what I mean? And how much crap he took for that. And I think he probably still would take some crap for that today, but it was just so interesting. Like to think that like biracial identity wasn't really a thing 20 years ago. You know what I mean? And now,
being multiracial
is so much more accepted. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, I don't know that he would be. I mean, obviously, there would still be some black people who were upset by that. And
right. That's what I mean today.
And would take it as an insult. But also, I think, like, generally, the sorts of people who think about this stuff and really try to understand things like racial identity would say, like, that he gets to do this. He gets to, you know, celebrate and respect and be a part of all of his heritage. You know, you don't get to decide that he has to choose one over the other. I think that's what, you know.
Right, I mean, I think, you know, say. Somebody says they're Blasian today, right? Like, you don't even blink an eye.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know.
I think the main, let's be honest, the main problem with that was the car.
Yeah, you're right. Like
you didn't have to put that in. He didn't have to put that in.
Also true. Also true. Yeah. You know. But yeah. You know. And it's different. Of course, we you know have a you know, we've had a president who's been multiracial since then, and a vice president elect, and you know. So it's a different world, and it was kind of cool to see some of that. You know, and you get a little bit of just the 90s feels that like The Last Dance gave you.
Yeah.
I'm all in. I can't wait to watch more of this.
I totally agree. I'm a little surprised we didn't hear from Fuzzy Zeller in the first episode. Perhaps that's coming in the second.
I have a feeling that might be coming. Yeah. We it's interesting because they get some into the reaction of golf to him or the golf world to him, but it's largely just been mostly about fame and the galleries and all of that stuff, which I think is a huge part of the story.
Totally.
But you're right. We haven't gotten into so much the other golfers. And I think they're beyond the Fuzzy Zeller thing. I think there's the economic impact he had on the tour and, you know, some of the player relations. And maybe we'll get more into that as in part two. You're right. There's probably still a lot to cover. But that was, it was a good time. I mean, I like Alex Gibney's stuff in general, so I had some expectation, but I did not necessarily expect this to be the most entertaining thing we watched this week. And for me, I think it was.
Ooh, interesting. Okay. Well, maybe that should transition us then if we're talking about how the things we watched weren't particularly entertaining, well, do you want me to agree with you or disagree with you?
You know, I don't want you to do anything. You want to go? Do you want to jump to the thing that I thought was the least entertaining this week?
Okay.
I feel that I have been misled about How To with John Wilson. I think we sort of talked about this in a kind of reminds me of I Think You Should Leave sort of scenario.
Let the credit where it's due. You said that, and I thought, really? That doesn't look like that to me. And in a way, you were right. I mean, in another way, this is nothing like that.
Yeah, but, yeah, they're different. I'm not talking about the styles of comedy.
Right.
But in the way that, like, people, like, smart people are like, this is hilarious. And then you watch it, and it feels like an Emperor's New Clothes sort of situation almost.
And maybe I'm a simpleton, but I literally have no other explanation for this. And for things like I Think You Should, like, there is no other explanation to me. Because, honestly, this show, How To with John Wilson, is much better than I Think You Should Leave. Let's start there.
Yes, agreed.
It has an oddball charm, and it has some definitely funny moments. And like, the lead, who you never really see, but is still clearly the lead, is charming. He like, in a weird way, you like him. I would not have said any of those nice things about I Think You Should Leave.
That's fair. That's fair. God, so, I Think You Should Leave is an abomination.
It really is. It really is. But I honestly cannot see an explanation for a universal critical acclaim for this show other than... Oh, shit, I didn't really get that. But I've heard it's like all these respectable people are saying it's good. I better just say it's good, too.
It does feel a little bit like groupthink, doesn't it? And the other thing I think, right, like Nathan, it's definitely from the Nathan For You tree. And Nathan Fielder is an executive producer on it, right? Uh-huh. So I think maybe that primed the pump. Because so many people feel the same way about that show, which I also think is good, but a little overrated.
I think it's a little overrated. The difference between this and Nathan For You is that Nathan For You is hilarious.
Yes.
This is never hilarious, and I'm not even sure it's trying to be. It's trying to be, like, weird and funny and charming. But, like, those things are all fine, and it succeeds sometimes and fails others, but ultimately none of that I just described is an elite, oh my God, look how incredible this is, it belongs on every top 10 list in the world show. It's just not.
I think you kind of nailed it in that it does occasionally have moments where it's funny or poignant. But they're really spread out. And in between, it is the same joke over and over again.
Yeah.
Like wry narration with some wacky people on video sort of backing it up. That's it. That's the whole show.
Yep.
And it moves kind of slow. So, like,
the word is boring. It's a boring show.
It's boring.
Yeah.
You said, because we kind of just had a conversation of the week. We do this sometimes to figure out how many episodes you're watching. And you were like, I watched two. And I was like, oh, that means it was either good or bad. It was going to be not in the middle anywhere, you know what I mean? And as I was watching, I was like, I totally got why you watched two, because two was the maximum I felt like I could take. It was inconceivable for me to watch a third episode of that,
right? And I'm not excited to sit down and watch it again, but I'm also not going to tell you it's bad. It's just, it's not much, I guess is what I might say. It's not much.
It's not bad. It's just overrated.
Yes, incredibly overrated. And that's the biggest takeaway for me, as it has become, I feel, far too often, is like, well, critics are either just completely full of shit or bad at their job, and it's hard for me to know which.
Yeah, there's another thing too, and I think this is a trap for critics. right? Like so many of them live in New York, and I think that there's they really capture what it's like to live in New York thing that critics overrate as like a quality for a TV show.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So yeah, I think that may play into it as well. Like you watch that second episode about scaffolding, I think is very New York. Even the relationship one.
Yeah.
Even though they don't spend the whole, show there, it's a lot about New York. You know what I mean?
100%. That's really what's happening here. In fact, maybe more than anything is critics live in New York, and this is a, another one of those, isn't New York just the greatest place and people who live here are the best and never have to go anywhere else to understand the world? And it's, I find that to be a thing about New York that is tiresome in general.
It's so tiresome. I had a conversation with somebody the other day trying to explain to them how like New York pride is like a virulent strain of local pride. And they were not understanding it.
Oh, were they from New York?
Westchester or whatever. But yeah, they took it personally, of course.
Right.
What
are you going to do?
It is what it is. it's most similar to like Texas pride, which I think is very weird. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're very different places.
That's the thing is like Texas pride is virulent, but I get it. Like, all right. I don't support it, but I get it. It's like
I think the thing that underpins both of them is exceptionalism, right? Though, you know what I mean?
No, I think mostly the thing that underpins the Texas one is like, we didn't even want to be a part of this thing in the first place.
I think you could argue that's a form of exceptionalism, but yes. Yes, that's
yeah,
fair.
I guess you're right. I guess in a way that is a form of exceptionalism, and yet like that's not what I think of when I think of exceptionalism.
All right. I actually am damn curious to know what you thought about Mythic Quest.
I thought it was fine. First of all, I'm not mad at it or anything, I guess. However, I couldn't do it right now.
Oh, okay.
It's it's a lot like It's Always Sunny or anything like that with horrible people. Who are entertaining for the most part. I stopped watching after the third episode, which was the episode about Nazi trolls causing cute little problems. I don't think I want to watch Nazi trolls cause cute little problems right now. It just doesn't seem that funny to me.
I wondered where you got into where you're getting into the right now thing about this. I don't actually know when this show came out. I guess I could look it up.
Well, yeah, but I don't know. I mean, they couldn't have known that the Nazi trolls would try to literally tear down our democracy. Well, they could have, but I couldn't really have fun with this.
Mm. I had a lot of fun with it. And I think to me, it's a classic workplace comedy. It's in that sort of almost like in the Parks and Rec or The Office or WKRP, whatever that tradition. It's people hanging out at a job. They're, quirky, somewhat dysfunctional. And then eventually you're gradually invested in their relationships and work related problems, right? Like that's pretty much it. But I think the characters are winning. The show is funny. The other thing, it's got a lot of the creator was a writer on Community.
Yeah.
She was the one actually that was harassed by Dan Harmon. Remember that whole episode. Yeah. And then went to It's Always Sunny. And so you can see she's kind of like picking up little bones from each of those different shows.
Uh-huh.
And I think it has some of that spirit, and it has a lot of community energy, right? Where, like, everybody's a little bit, like, everybody sort of has their distinct character quirks and personalities, and they kind of rub up against each other the wrong way, but there's, like, a love that sort of underpins it all. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I'm
not going to argue with any of that.
Becomes really enjoyable to watch them hang out over the course of the season. At the end of the season, and I'm assuming this one came out after the rest of it, there's a pandemic episode.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that.
And
I mean, I didn't watch it.
I really love the quarantine episode, which I think only works if you like the characters. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I didn't. For the record, I didn't dislike the characters. I thought it was pretty funny. I just like I was like trying to watch the cute Nazi problems. The day after the Nazis were here.
I think that's unfortunate. Honestly, I mean, obviously it's unfortunate in every sense, but timing wise, I think it's really unfortunate because it's not like the show is.
No, it's not about
that. You know what I mean?
It was a pure coincidence. It's just like I couldn't. But that what you said makes me want to sort of get back into it at some point.
Yeah, and the other thing I would say is it's really well cast. You know what I mean? To have like F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, he is very funny. You know what I mean?
As like the old science fiction writer with the drinking problem.
Yeah.
Danny Pudi's great in, in everything I've seen him in.
He's
you
so
know,
funny.
And
he's just so funny.
Yeah, his character in this show I think is tremendous. And there's a lot of people I don't know, but I think are really sort of good at their roles, and they all I think have really good chemistry together. And then of course,
Mac's great.
Mac's great.
He's doing his thing.
He's, and it's definitely not a big jump from the It's Always Sunny character.
No,
but it's a different character, but still maintains a lot of like his unself-aware preening.
Yes,
and it's used to great comic effect.
I agree with all of that.
Yeah,
I agree.
I don't know. I'm in on the show. I understand why you feel that way. I would suggest to you if you had watched that episode 3 days earlier.
Yeah,
it
would have been pretty funny. No, you're absolutely right about that. I'm not debating it at all. It's just it was bad timing, so I'll have to get back into it.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a pretty strong recommend on Mythic Quest. I'd put it up. I don't know about right up there with Tiger. It's definitely a more fluffy show.
It's escapism or what have you, but it was funny.
Yeah, if you need a comedy binge, I would put a hearty recommendation out there for this show, which I've kind of gone undiscovered. This to me, I think, is the opposite of How To with John Wilson, and that I saw it on a few lists. That's how I found it, but not talked about a lot. I don't think too many people know about it.
Yeah, agreed. All right. I think a lot of people know about our last thing. I'm a little surprised you didn't enjoy it more based on what you've said so far during the podcast, because I thought History of Swear Words was wonderful.
I wouldn't say wonderful.
The whole thing. We watched the whole thing.
Oh, you did? Wow.
Yeah.
You know what it reminded me of? Like those VH1
Best week ever
specials that they used to do. Best week ever, or I Love the 90s,
right.
Or you know what I mean. But about swearing, and by the way, that's not criticism. I enjoyed all those shows, but I would say I enjoyed this too. I just found it to be it's just very lightweight. You know what I mean? Like it's I liked watching it. I might watch some more of it at some point. It also feels pretty inessential. But yeah, I don't have anything bad to say about it.
But it's inessential. You know what, bro? I think you're being reductionist about swearing in about this documentary in the same way that people have treated swear words over the years. Like, yeah, they seem disposable, but as we learned from the show, that you can get actual literal benefits physically and mentally from using swear words.
Yeah. I think it's interesting and clever. I'm not down on the show. I don't know. Like, did you feel like you were watching great television?
I feel like I laughed an awful lot.
Okay. Yeah, you might have laughed more than me.
I thought it was really funny. I thought Nicolas Cage was hilarious. I thought, you know, the whole plan, as goofy and ridiculous as it was, I found the whole thing really enjoyable. I did.
Yeah. All right. Look, like I said, there's nothing bad to say about it. Nothing bad to say about it.
Even the way you're saying that sounds bad.
Maybe I should curse more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, fun. I don't cast me on board with being anti-cursing.
Okay, just making sure. Yeah. Just want to make sure we're still on the same page about life.
I like that. I do like, one of the things I did like was that they got a lot of the, they really, you know, like, if you're going to do an episode about shit, like, go get the Clay Davis. You know
yes.
what I mean?
Yes.
and use it to good effect.
Yeah, and my wife, I recently learned, has never seen The Wire, so we have just started a rewatch. So I was like, you'll learn about him later.
Yeah, I think we talked about this last week, right? Did you?
Did we? It's possible.
Maybe we talked about it offline. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but yeah, that's
how far in are you?
About halfway through season one. I mean, we just started a week or so ago.
Okay. And where is your wife at on The Wire? Currently.
Like, how much does she like it?
Yes. What is her opinion of it?
She likes it, but she's definitely enjoying it. Like, she's excited to watch more of it night to night. But I don't know if she's totally has realized why it's the greatest show of all time. It's like we've watched 6 episodes or something.
Yeah, well, I think I've said this before. It really took me 4 or 5 before I felt like I was super into it, which is kind of why I asked, because I felt like that's around there sort of an interesting inflection point for where you're going to get hooked or not, just because the story, unfolds slowly. My mom watched the – sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think this last episode is probably the one where most of us – the first time we're like, oh, a lot of stuff went down. So I think we're getting right into the part where she's going to start to be like, oh man, this is pretty incredible.
Yeah. And then once you hit that downhill, it's like binge.
Right. Although one of the things I'm fascinated about is to see her reaction to season 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's always key. My mom watched the first episode and was like, I'm out. and she felt like it kind of like glorified police corruption. And I was like, it's not that show. Like, I promise you, keep going.
Just calm down, mom. Yeah. This will get to where you want it to go.
Yeah. And so, I was trying to explain to her, like, what the show's eventually going to try to do. And I was talking about season 2. And so she's like thinking about skipping straight to season 2.
No.
And I don't know. No.
Hold on. Is your mom listening right now? She's probably listening, right?
It's possible. It's quite possible, yeah.
Okay, Derek's mom. I understand. I totally understand what you're saying, and I understand why you're feeling the way that you feel. But think of this as a building being built. And if you just leave out half the foundation, none of the rest of the building is going to make sense to you. So just bear with it and get through that first. It's only, you know, even if you're hating half the season, it's only a few hours of your time. In the end, you'll be happier for it, I promise.
Yeah. It is one of those things, right? We've talked about this. Like, everything means something on the show, right? So
yes.
It's like
all the pieces matter, as Lester Freeman says.
Right. So there's going to be stuff that pops up through the entire series. Like, it's not just like, hey, if you miss some stuff in season 1, you won't get it in season 2. It's like some of that stuff comes back in like season 4 or season 5. You know
exactly.
What I mean? So
yeah. You really got to lock in.
Yeah. All right. Well, good. I'm glad I have some backup on that.
Uh-huh. Totally. Happy to help.
all right. How are we doing on time? I think we might be kind of close to there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is trending in the right direction. Sure.
You got anything? This is the kiss of death. But do you got anything you want to add on the NFL or the NBA before we go?
I have so much is the problem. I mean, look, by the time people hear this, who knows, like, what's going to be happening in the NBA? I just got a Windhorst alert that multiple NBA players who previously tested positive for COVID recently tested positive for a second time. There are meetings going on with the Players Association and Board of Governors talking about what to do. It's deeply upsetting the way
that's not just a basketball bomb. That's like a science bomb.
It's a bit of a science bomb. But I do think like the length of immunity has already, people already thought it was not that long. You know, the antibodies that you produce by beating the virus only protect you for a few months, I think. So the issue really is that, I don't know, did you see the whole Andrew Bogut thing yesterday?
No.
Bogut somehow got access to, I mean, I think we can surmise how, got access to the league memo about coronavirus health and safety protocols, which, as it turns out, include a provision that any player can have up to two guests in their room on road trips, either family members or longtime friends who live in the city that they're visiting, is the way it's written in the memo. But, like, how are you going to tell me the Instagram model at the front desk is not a longtime friend who lives in the city? You know, like, I don't.
Right.
So, and those people are not tested.
That's the reason that rule is written in there.
Those people are not tested. They're not in the protocols in any way, and they're in and out of rooms theoretically every night of a road trip. So all of a sudden, I'm not so sure the NBA is taking or took the virus seriously at all coming into this season, which is very strange after, you know, the thing that got them through the end of last season was playing in a literal bubble out of an abundance of caution. It's we talked about this on the radio yesterday, but it's almost as if the NBA took the approach of like, well, we beat that virus, so we don't really have to worry about it too much this time around.
I would guess, and look, this is 100% speculation on my part. Obviously, you don't have a lot of inside NBA info, but this strikes me as a reaction to the clear, and honestly, I don't think we've really heard the full story yet. It's one of those things that gets said, and
the mental health issues in the bubble
deeper than
is
that.
What you're gonna
but
say,
yeah,
right?
The mental health issues in the bubble.
Okay,
I think it really got to players, and I think that this sort of thing exists specifically because of that.
I think you are right, but no, it does not make sense. And I think you realize. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's a sensible policy.
No, I know.
That's my explanation for why it exists.
I think you're right, but in that case, I say shame on you, Players Association, because the Players Association is supposed to keep players safe. There's no need for a Players Association if all it's going to do is advocate for things that any individual player would advocate for all by themselves. Like, the point of a friggin' Players Association is to represent the health and interest of the whole group. And this is a stupid concession. It should not have been asked for. It's obviously not safe. So I don't know how, like, I honestly, even though what you're saying is true, I'm sure that's it, it still boggles my mind that this got through on either side. For the owners, it's tragically irresponsible, and beyond that, it puts in danger the assets in players that you spend millions upon millions upon millions of dollars to have playing for you, not sick. And from player standpoint, like, there are so many other ways to deal with your loneliness or what have you. Like, this is not the way.
Yeah. And to me, isn't the answer here almost like more breaks in the season?
There's a lot of ways you can do it. I would argue there are
a couple week breaks where people could go home and spend more time with their families or whatever.
You could do breaks like that on the way back in. Yes, you could do breaks like that. You could still do people allowed into the bubble, but they have to be people who are willing to go through a testing protocol and quarantine and then stay for a while. But they needed to, at the very least, have every team in their own bubble so that there's some protection against this virus. And I sort of thought that was what they were doing because I hadn't seen the details of it. But now that you see the details, it's pretty clear that is not what they were doing.
Yeah.
And that to me is not only disappointing, but it dooms the season. And if you don't change those protocols, you're going to have to cancel.
Right. Right now, the Eastern Conference Player of the Week, the reigning Eastern Conference Player of the Week is Jason Tatum, who has COVID.
Right.
And the Western Conference Player of the Week is Luka Doncic, who can't play because his team doesn't have enough players because of contact tracing protocol within Dallas.
Right.
So, you know, if you don't think that this is having a major effect on the product, you know, the 76ers can barely field a team.
Right.
I understand we're coming to accept a sort of, we're going through the flow. We're like the NFL, right? Like, well, we're getting through it. This is what it is. We're going to play.
It's not going to work like that with the NBA because they play every couple days and it'll spread like wildfire in a way that it did not in the NFL.
And there are fewer players and it's a more player dependent league, you know, a more star dependent league. Right. Yep. Some things have to change, and I think some things likely will. It seems like the NBA's owners are smart, many of them.
But how smart are they? If we got honestly, I understand, I guess, why the players might have asked for this sort of absurd concession to the protocols, but the fact that they actually started a season, literally, just okaying guys having untested, unquarantined guests in their hotel rooms, like, it's just so obviously you just were not serious about disease safety at all. There's really no middle ground there.
Yeah, I mean, we heard a lot, and look, and the NBA got a lot of credit, and I'd say deservedly so, for how well the bubble went.
That's right.
But what we heard about that was how much we were in consultation with epidemiologists and all of that, right? To like come up with our protocols. This protocol that you're talking about couldn't have possibly gone through an epidemiologist, right?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
There's no way.
No epidemiologist would okay that
in this process.
That's a great question.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't know the answer to that because I only know about the memo because of Andrew Bogut. He is going to be on our radio show today, so we'll see if he has any additional information. But I'm not sure he does. I think he just, you know, somebody he knows in the league probably just sent him the memo, and he was like, "What?" And then he talked about it on his podcast.
That's wild.
Yeah, it is wild, and it's disappointing because, as you're sort of pointing out, like, the NBA had done a good enough job that I was kind of proud to be an NBA fan around the COVID thing, you know? Like, good job. Yeah. The league I like best has been the most responsible about this. Like, maybe somewhere deep in their money-grubbing hearts, they do care slightly about human beings. But as it turns out, probably not.
I mean, I think it's easy to It feels like the NBA is the league that cares most about its players as people. But I think sometimes we forget that that is a low bar. You know what I mean? When you're just looking around at the competition. So that doesn't necessarily mean, just because they care more than, say, the NFL, doesn't mean they care a lot.
Right.
And I think it can be easy to get sort of caught up in that. Speaking of which, did you enjoy the triple header format this year?
I did.
In the NFL playoffs?
Why does it sound like you did not? Why are you saying that as if you did not enjoy it?
Well, look, I'm not against three games in a day is great. Three games in a day, 2 days in a row is great.
Great.
There were two good games like out of the six, though. So,
yeah, that part wasn't the best, but you know,
yeah.
What are you gonna do? I thought
I'm still
even
against playoff expansion personally.
Really, even though it wasn't a good game per se, I thought Steelers Browns was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, Steelers Browns was interesting in the car wreck aspect of it almost.
I mean, I couldn't take my eyes off of the car wreck that was the Pittsburgh Steelers. And then they honestly could have gotten right back into it if their coach hadn't turned into a gigantic chicken in the middle of the start of the fourth quarter. Like, what was that?
That was weird. Mike Vrabel turning into a chicken, I thought was equally weird.
Yep. It's right? All pretty weird.
That's one of the most like savvy, cunning coaches in the NFL, right? Like that's the guy who thinks about bleeding four extra minutes off the clock with like bizarre penalty rules and stuff, right?
Right.
And he's punting in maybe the worst punting situation of the year.
Yeah, it was crazy.
If not the one that Mike Tomlin, who I think is a Hall of Fame coach, decided to punt it as well. Like it's just
right.
That part of it was pretty weird.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
But like, you know, I don't know. I think I was just ready for like 3 days of playoff football intensity, and there was a lot of meh. There was a lot of meh in between Buffalo, Indy. And I'm trying to think, what was the other good game? I guess it was the
Seattle Rams.
I mean, that game was okay. That game was close. I mean, I guess Tampa Bay, Washington was pretty close.
I mean, and none of them were like all timers, but you know, I don't know. I didn't think it was bad, and I enjoyed football all day, 2 days in a row.
Yeah. I don't even know if you watched the game. I know you're not a college guy.
I did. I watched probably the first half semi-carefully before I sort of drifted off into Twitter. It's so boring. It's the slowest, most boring sport.
They really need to do something about the length of games.
It's just
there were a lot of people who were good at playing it in that particular game.
But they stand out like a sore thumb because they're so much better than all the people around them. And by the way, I didn't think Josh Fields was that good, but
Justin Fields. But yes.
Sorry, Josh Fields is that old White Sox third baseman. I was not super impressed by Justin Fields. I know he like I was more impressed the previous week, but like that's the problem is it's so hard to know what any of it means because no one's any good. It's college sports
any good and this is the reason I just brought it up.
Nick Saban. Yeah.
Like it's pretty incredible what Nick Saban has done. Like when you step back and you just look at the consistency year to year.
He's done an unbelievable job. He's pretty clearly not that I'm the expert, but it seems to me he's pretty clearly the greatest college football coach ever. Let me just tell you a story, and you can decide if anything, it has to do with Nick Saban. When I was a kid, I was an advanced math student. When I was in middle school, in eighth grade, I rode a short bus to the high school because, you know, I was taking a level of math that they didn't offer at middle school. And then I was like 2 years ahead of my class. And then when I got to my junior year in my junior year in high school, I had two options. I could take what was called BC calculus, which was essentially a full year of college level calculus.
I'm pretty sure I know where you're going with this. Continue.
A full year of college level calculus. And then as a senior, I would have to like go over to Northwestern to take multivariable or I could take AB calculus, which was the equivalent of one semester of college calculus stretched out over the whole year. And when I saw that, I was like, I don't want to take the same calculus twice, so I'll just take BC. And after 2 days, I said, you know what? AB seems like a better idea, and I dropped down a level. That's the story.
I get it. I think that that somewhat underrates Nick Saban's year with the Dolphins. Look, it obviously wasn't, there's some Saban,
let me
Saban
be clear.
Revisionism there. I
could have done it. I didn't fail out of BC calculus. I just looked around and thought, this will not be an easy A, and I'm a junior in high school. I don't need this struggle. You know what I mean? And like, there's just, I don't, I can't, if we're going to judge Nick Saban, I can't get past that. I just can't. He's an incredible, incredible college football coach, a remarkable recruiter. And I, in some ways, the college job is harder than the pro job. And if you want to say, hey, you know, it's not a cop out, he's working even more down at this level and he has a bigger impact and maybe that's what he cares about. He'd rather be around the kids. Like, those are all fine things.
Right. And we're seeing a lot of college, like not even that necessarily accomplished college coaches step right into the NFL now and have success. Right. So like,
who are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of Matt Rhule.
Of the, what his team Cliff... won five games this year.
Okay. Yeah. But there, everyone thinks that that team's on the upswing. Okay, you know what I mean? Like,
but people probably thought Saban's Dolphins were on the upswing before he snuck out the back door.
I guess. What about Pete Carroll?
You Pete know, Carroll,
like Jim Harbaugh.
Harbaugh, you know? I think is questionable as a coach overall at best. I think he's incredibly overrated. I can't believe Michigan just
the man
paid
had
that
success
money.
In the NFL. Did he not?
Yeah, he had short-term success until he drove everybody nuts and then was fired.
Okay. But he would, you know, like he'll be able to get an NFL job someday, I think.
Unless, oh boy,
unless this Michigan thing goes south.
The Michigan thing already has gone south. But Harbaugh's complicated. Pete Carroll is a success story. I don't see a lot of others. Kingsbury isn't.
I guess I don't know. I think
he looks totally overmatched.
Guys get hired. I'm also talking about people like Joe Brady, who's not a head coach in the NFL yet. But maybe within 2-3 months.
No, and look, right? That's fine. Let's see how they do. But I don't think, like, I don't really think it's up for debate that, generally speaking, the best football coaches of the sport of football are in the NFL. You know, and
yeah, I guess. But I also think it's right. Like, Saban has NFL history, and B, he's super respected by all those guys. Right? Like, he has great relationships with all those guys.
Totally.
So,
Look,
you know, it'll be really interesting to see, by the way. I think Urban Meyer seems like a legit NFL candidate this cycle, and I will be fascinated to see what his NFL career looks like.
Exactly.
I think
it doesn't take anything.
Spurrier, like coming up and not doing any work, like those days are over, right?
No, because you can't coach college like that anymore either. This isn't even a knock on Nick Saban. He can do whatever he wants. I'm just saying, you're the best at the thing that's not as good. And that's fine. I don't like Bill Belichick any more than I like Nick Saban, but Bill Belichick is the best of the best.
Right? So
that's a huge accomplishment. A lot of people love college football. My dismissive, like me being a dick about college football shouldn't hurt anyone's feelings.
It hurts mine. But that's okay.
Of all the things for you to like, college football is probably the most off-brand.
That might be true. That might be true. I can't really argue with that.
Like, it's an inferior product that takes blatant advantage of labor in a way that's incredibly uncomfortable, even if you don't think about the racism.
This was absolutely the hardest year to watch it, too. No doubt. I have no argument there.
I am at a point where now when anytime college sports come up on the radio, I begin whatever I'm going to say by saying, just a reminder, college sports should be abolished in favor of a semi-professional league that feeds the major sports leagues. But, and then I say whatever I have to say.
I think we may get there somewhere.
I mean, this is embarrassing what's happening this year. They played the national championship game with like half of Ohio State's starters out with COVID. Come on, man.
Yeah, it's bad. It's really bad.
Come on.
And you've got one team who was, 11-0? I don't remember what the record was. Versus he was 7-0.
I believe it was 12. And by the way, to get that 7-0 team there, they had to cancel the rules. The Big Ten had to cancel the rules they made before the season about the required number of games to get into the Big Ten championship game, or Indiana would have played in the Big Ten championship game. So yeah.
the whole thing's a farce. I had no argument against that. Although I do – it is another real feather in Alabama's cap, right? Like the thing that people said about them year after year was, well, you know, they play those games against the Alabama Southern and whatever, and they never play out of conference. And here they go against an all SEC schedule, and they score 35 points in every game and dominate.
But
like,
that doesn't make
go 12-0.
Hold on, that doesn't make those criticisms any less true. Those criticisms are true. It's part of what makes Nick Saban a spectacular college football coach. Is he takes advantage of the system.
Well, it's not entirely true because Alabama is now – they aggressively schedule one really good non-conference game now. But
yes, but they also aggressively schedule ones against, like, Division 1A.
Yeah. You know, they make that move.
And again, it's the same thing to me. Like, I can't blame you or really criticize you for that move because that's the game. You're playing the game as it's designed. But it's a rigged game. So being the best ever at a rigged game is like, okay, congratulations to you and people who like that.
Yeah. You know, CFP has a problem too in that. The playoff has 21 games in history, and 17 of those have been won by three schools.
You know how they can fix some of that?
That's going to be a real problem for fan bases at large. People, I mean, there are too many fan bases feel like they're left out of this thing.
The best way to fix that is to expand the playoffs because, like, either there are other teams that are also good who are not getting involved, or Alabama is that much better than everybody, but at least the other games will be good.
Yeah, it's the latter. There's a real separation between those three teams. But I think you're right. I think they're going to expand the playoffs. I don't think it's going to change who ultimately wins, but it'll change that stat a little bit, right? Because they're just going to
more
games
like
for team to win.
Nick Saban can probably win 50% of the national championships until he retires, right? I mean, what would stop him from doing that?
Right. And, you know, and whether it remains Clemson or some other team jumps up and, you know, becomes a second team, it'll be them and Ohio State and team three.
Right.
You know, for as long as Nick Saban wants to do it. He's the same age as Bear Bryant was when he retired currently. So I don't know how long he's going to go.
Well, but you'll be watching anxiously to find out.
Yeah. All right, let's do homework.
Oh, man. By the way, we crossed an hour, so I torpedoed your short show.
All right, Tiger Part 2 coming up this week. And then you want to tell people about Promising Young Woman?
Not really. It's a movie starring Carey Mulligan that has gotten a lot of buzz, and some people I like and respect very much believe it is truly exceptional. So we're going to rent it. We're going to pay for this one, folks.
It's in the tough watch genre, though, right?
I mean, I think it's – in some ways, it certainly is in the tough watch category. But I do think it's, as I understand, both thrilling and funny. So,
good. Okay.
Like upsetting, some upsetting subject matter, I think, but also sort of a lady led takedown of the patriarchy in some ways.
All right. F you, patriarchy. Patriarchy.
Yeah, seriously. Screw the whole thing.
Patriarchy, Regina King making her directorial debut.
Yeah, baby.
In One Night in Miami. Which I think is on Amazon.
That's
correct.
I'm
remembering that correctly.
You are.
So we're gonna watch that. It's about the night that Cassius Clay met up with Malcolm X and Jim Brown and someone else I'm forgetting that you know and love.
Yeah, and everyone other than, I don't recognize the guy who plays Cassius Clay. Of course, most people realize Cassius Clay eventually changes his name to Muhammad Ali and becomes the greatest boxer ever. I guess he was he played a character in Ballers, but I don't remember him. The other leads are names and actors you know well. Kingsley Ben-Ader, who we've seen a lot lately, is Malcolm X. Odom Jr.
He's having a year.
He is. Leslie Odom Jr. plays Sam Cooke, and Aldis Hodge, who you may not know by name, but you definitely would recognize. What has he been in? He was MC Ren in Straight Outta Compton. He was in Hidden Figures. Like, you definitely recognize him. I'm excited about this. Lance Reddick makes an appearance.
My man Lance Reddick.
Also having a year. Maybe.
Hopefully we'll recognize him this time.
I recognized him the first time. Speak for yourself.
Oh, you did?
Can't put on a couple LBs and be recognized by Derek Madden. It's disrespectful.
That's right. All right, so we're watching that. And then one more episode of Small Axe, episode, movie, whatever you want to call it. Come back to our discussion at the beginning.
It's an episode in a series of films.
Yes, Red, White, and Blue.
That's it.
Is that one. So there you go. That's your fourth homework. And then, of course, we'll be back on Thursday to break down another episode of The Challenge.
Yeah, buddy. If four films isn't enough or four homeworks isn't enough, we'll just waste time talking about the NFL and the NBA again until the podcast is a little too long.
That will also almost certainly happen next week.
And yeah, Thursday, Challenge. Don't miss it. Can't wait. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the lights out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.